Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm totally and utterly surrounded by my stuff. On my right is my great library of RPGs and my Grognard Files. Here on my left is the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Carol M. Munro. I'll just give it a tap. Ah, this time she's been replaced by a little book. Caroline Munro, Reality Behind the Fantasy. It's a recently revived memoir available from her website and other online retailers. There's a link in the show notes. And that's because we're once again in a reflective mood looking back on 2025 and doing a review of the year. Some of the highs and the lows, and we'll be awarding the groggies. This was the year that I went from the forever GM to a whenever GM to a whatever GM. Yes, the so-called GM-itis kicked in early in the year. I really enjoyed playing loads and loads of games. Judge Blythe, our resident rules lawyer, joins me in the room of role-playing rambling to reflect and just look back on the year. One of your favourite and my favourite podcasts from last year was the one with Magnus Zeta about Swedish role-playing culture. During the conversation, he set a challenge to explore different RPG cultures from around the world. So I'm going to take on that challenge during 2026. I'm going to start with my friend Callum, who started the Released podcast around the same time as the Grognard Files, and we've been in correspondence ever since. He's from Belgium, and so in this episode I talked to him about French-speaking RPGs. He's very good about Nephilim, a game that I knew very little of. I'm very interested to find out more about it. He's also about to launch a Kickstarter, but more about that in the interview. Well, let's get on with it. Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Vimbox!
Welcome to the Zoom of Roleplaying Rambling, where I'm joined by podcaster, games designer, and bon viveur, Callum. Hello there, Callum.
Hello, Dirk. Thanks for having me.
A bon anniversaire on being at 10 years. 10 years of Released podcast.
Likewise, have a nice anniversary for the Grog. Now, I think we literally started on the same month of August. That was 2015.
And if people don't know of your podcast, tell them what that's about.
So the Released is kind of a collection. Over time, it developed into a collection of a couple different podcasts, but the idea was to be the show of tabletop RPG fans across the channel, the pond, and beyond. The starting point really was that, as people might tell from my accent, French is my first language. I was born in Belgium. And in 2012, I moved to London. And the first way I found to socialize then was to find a group of people on Facebook, because Facebook was much nicer then. But I find a thing called La Guilde des Rôlistes Francophones de Londres, so the Guild of French-speaking role players of London. And yeah, around that same time, I was listening to podcasts, and so I was like, oh, it would be fun to interview the members of that club and have this perspective of people who are both with one foot in the English-speaking role-playing world and the French-speaking ones. And very quickly, it evolved into something broader because there are lovely English-speaking, of course, other clubs in London for role-playing games, especially the Roleplay Heaven, was extremely welcoming and supportive. I'm thinking about, like, for instance, one of the founder, Gary Harper. So very quickly, I got guests on the show who are not just from the French-speaking club, but trying to be outward-looking, opening up the perspective. Because for me, role-playing has always been about making connections between different people, different hobbies, different interests. You like Star Wars, there's a role-playing game which is based on Star Wars. You do role-playing game, you're introduced to Tolkien and so on.
Yeah, and particularly in the early days, I really used to enjoy that sense that it was friends coming together and there was a nice authentic sound about it.
Thank you very much. And I also really love the Grognard Files on my... I thought they were, yeah, sort of sibling show because on your side, you were giving a very British perspective on things. But it was interesting how there were aspects of the British Grognard experience that you were representing, which I recognize with my own experience, you know, similarities like not being as D&D dominated, for instance, and interest in different style of games and, you know, mixing the old and the new. I always like that about the Grognard Files and the...
Talk about some of your early years in role-playing then, back in Belgium. And so what kind of things were you playing and who were you playing with?
Well, my journey was a bit... it went off on a... Not exactly a full start, but it was a bit rough. I just saw in a magazine, you know, it was a kid's magazine, maybe it was Journal de Spirou, Spirou magazine or Journal de Mickey, which was a Disney one. And there was an ad approaching Christmas. They just mentioned the Star Wars role-playing game from West End Games. And I believe it would have been 1993, maybe 1994. And I had no idea what a role-playing game was, but I saw the book and I was a huge fan of Star Wars back then. And I was also a bit spoiled by my divorced parents. So my father accepted to buy me this role-playing game book, despite me not knowing what it was. I have no clue how he found it. And he just told me, oh, wow, that's a rather expensive book. And I got this role-playing game book. I read through it. We used to play a lot of board games with my mother, but I couldn't make heads or tails about how to play Star Wars, the role-playing game. I tried to run it in a kitchen with a friend and it was not very successful. I tried to find clubs I could join and so on. And it was, a bit rough, a couple of weird experience. And it took half a decade before I finally ran into, at my high school, I joined a theater troupe and there was an older student there reading a French magazine called Casus Belli, which is a great, I guess it's kind of our own White Dwarf with his old French flavor. He was reading that magazine of which I had copies myself. And I was like, oh, you're into role-playing game? He was like, yeah. I mean, I would really like to play it. And that's when things got serious for me. So around 98, I played for a couple of years, but you know, thinking back those couple years feels like a full decade because it was really, really packed with a lot of gaming, a lot of Star Wars, a French game called Nightcrawler, Nephilim, which is my big obsession, but also Legend of the Five Rings and Vampire the Masquerade as well. But just 2 years of very packed role-playing. Then so going to uni, drifting a bit away from that. And it's only when I moved to London back in 2012 that, I got back into it.
Just going back to that magazine, what was the title of it? And what kind of content was in it? Just describe it to us. So when that came, what kind of things were you getting in there?
So it's called Casus Belli. And you can find them on the archive, the free the archive.org. They got issues there. I'm not sure it's fully legal, but you can find the PDF there. And it sort of evolved from a war gaming game, but unlike White Dwarf, it was not tied to a publisher of any sort. So they had quite a lot of freedom. And you can see over the issues, it turns from a war gaming magazine, Casus Belli again, even it's in the title. They evolved more towards role-playing game. And by the time I think the magazine was probably 4 years old or something like that, maybe five when I started reading it. You had reviews of games, some articles about what was going on in the world of role-playing game, maybe some theory of things. But the very attractive thing for me in the middle of it, you had a bit which was black and white printed, unlike the rest of the magazine, which was color. And they made fantastic adventures and mysteries for a wide array of role-playing games. So it was quite fascinating as someone who was not quite in the scene who struggled to find a table to join, to actually see the array of games that they were playing, that Castle Falkenstein, Warhammer Fantasy of Nephilim, Vampire the Masquerade. Actually, this magazine, back in the 90s, so in the 98 when I played, people, Vampire the Masquerade was very popular, and the question in Belgium and France was not, do you play Vampire the Masquerade? The question was, do you play Chicago or Paris? Because this magazine created their own special edition, which was called Paris by Night. And this became a very, very popular setting for Vampire the Masquerade among French speakers.
What's missing from the array of games that you're talking about there is Dungeons and Dragons. And so is that not particularly part of the culture of French-speaking role-playing games?
It was there. And, you know, I went back going through, you know, kind of, if I had more time, I would do a show about this magazine. It would be interesting, I think, to take someone like yourself or a Briton, maybe someone who can read French, and go through the issues and see it evolves over time and what's the content. So it really definitely starts with D&D and so on. But by the time I got myself into the hobby, we were in this window, which was after the sort of demise of TSR, but before the coming of Wizards of the Coast. So, you know, I remember going to tabletop role-playing shops. Amazingly, there were like three of them in my city, which is not that such a huge city, but you had a lot of choice. And you had all those AD&D supplements there, but they were kind of gathering dust. I mean, it's not like they were exactly unpopular, but they were just one of a lot of mystery to them because they look a bit ancient. I related quite a bit with the Grognard files because things like RuneQuest, Call of Cthulhu appear to be things that were more popular. The only difference I would say with what you describe is in my days and place, Vampire the Masquerade was really like half of the tables felt like there were some sort of Vampire the Masquerade thing going on because, you know, the French, especially they like their court in Paris. They can play a toreador and feel very fancy about it.
And from your podcast, I first heard of Nephilim. Tell me a bit about that because, like I said, it was something I knew nothing of until I heard about it on your podcast.
Yeah, so it's based, the original edition of Nephilim is based, it used the BRP system, so it was built on the Call of Cthulhu system and the RuneQuest one. Interestingly, the game master who ran it for me had it for a similar reason, again, as some experience you described, because his brother had bought another game, and the rule was one game master, one game, and if you buy something, you need to buy something else. So he was in the shop, and he picked up randomly Nephilim. But yeah, it's a French role-playing game. It's contemporary occult, so it's taking place present day. It's kind of contemporary occult, which is quite popular. Again, modern day Call of Cthulhu, Vampire the Masquerade is something French speakers vibed quite a lot with. But in Nephilim, you play beings. For me, it's fixed an issue, a frustration I had with Vampire the Masquerade. Because when I first played Vampire the Masquerade, I was like, oh, you can play an immortal. I want to play someone who lived through this time in history way back. And the first thing you're told in Vampire the Masquerade is like, no, you cannot play that. You can play someone from the 70s at most, because otherwise you're too powerful. And I always thought it was a bit weird. You play immortals, but young ones only. Well, in Nephilim, you play beings who are immortal, who are actually older than humankind itself. Some theories said that they created humankind. They lived in Atlantis. They're sort of like in that movie with Denzel Washington, Fallen, a being that need to possess human beings in order to engage with our world. So depending who you ask, you are a demon of sort. It's much more agnostic, I would say. It's not very religious. But really the idea is, yeah, you this being, you lived through Napoleonic War, maybe you were there in the Neolithic, you know, war, fire sort of things. You went in ancient Egypt, and then you got trapped into an artifact for several centuries until you got activated again, and you wake up and you possess a human. And not only you possess a human, but the human become part of you, and you become part of the human because over time you start borrowing the, in mechanical terms, you start borrowing the skills of the humans. And if you have a critical success, the skills of your avatar become your own. You cannot lose them, even if you get killed. The bonus of the game is that if you get killed as the human, your actual self, which is ethereal, can travel and try quickly to find another human. Otherwise, they're going to be trapped again in their artifact. But that means you develop all those skills from, I was an SOE agent during World War II, so I still know how to use weapon and to build a bomb. But actually, today, I'm an astrophysician at NASA, and I'm investigating something that is going on. So there's this fun min-maxing things of having your Nephilim, having this crazy collection. It's like, oh yeah, you play Call of Cthulhu, you start with a professor, then they get killed, and your next character is an assassin, and then your next character is a former Soviet Spetsnaz or something because you're tired of getting killed. Well, in Nephilim, instead of moving on, they build up to one another. You play the professor that added up the skills of the assassins and later became a Spetsnaz as well, and you got these skills which can go like 120% of the BRP scale, which means you never fail, or you make things a bit more difficult for yourself to make it exciting.
And as players, what are the adventures like? So what do you do in that setting?
Yeah, the core notion is that Nephilim have a thirst for knowledge. And they also, not only they possess people over time, but there's a lot of things they've forgotten. There's sort of an amnesia. So they try to investigate who they were and what they're up to. So your first adventure, very often you're woken up by someone who, hey, I found your artifact and I managed to get you out of your artifact. You owe me, so you're going to do a mission for me. Going through that, you find out about the different factions going on. The Nephilim's got factions based on the blades, the cards of the tarot. You've got factions for the humans, which are minor arcana, which are based on another type of tarot, which is the coin, the sticks, the sword. So you fight Templar, Synarch, Rosicrucians. And you start getting involved in all the politics of that, and you sort of decide to find your place to be proactive about that by being like, okay, what I want to do is to become powerful, or in my case was, well, I want to cohabit with humans and I want to learn as much as possible. I started my character as a very pacific being. And then over the course of the thing, we found that, well, actually there's a creature or person called Lilith who's going to wake up and bring about the apocalypse. And my character in that case was the camping was like, oh, okay, well, I want to protect the humans. And through a different set of circumstances, I acquired tactical and strategic knowledge from the time of Troy, which I apply in modern day. And I ended up being the big general of an army who decided to protect the world from the armies of Lilith. And it was really funny because I started as a pacifist, but basically it's usually, there's a new artifact that showed up at the British Museum. Oh, I recognize this artifact. This is actually the sword of Menelaus of the Battle of Troy. And it happens that I knew Nephilim, that it was their stasis. So chances are they are into this stasis. So we're going to go rob the British Museum after they rob a lot of other people. And we're going to recover the sword and get our friend back out of the sword. And when we get the friend back out of the sword, for some reason, it's very unhappy and creates a lot of mess. And you need to save the day while at the same time, a bit like Vampire the Masquerade, keeping it quiet. Like in Vampire the Masquerade, there's the idea of this, yeah, we're around, but the secret society, and we don't want people to find out about Nephilim running about. So some humans control the media, some others control the politics, and some Nephilim do as well. And everybody's like, okay, we erase a thing. Nobody needs to know about that. Typical Delta Green also, and again, Vampire the Masquerade type of thing.
So it says French game.
It's a French game, yeah.
Yeah, it was developed in France, and then I believe Chaosium went on to publish it, didn't they?
Yes, there's a US adaptation of the game. Interestingly, System Mastery did an episode about it, which was quite negative about the US adaptation, and they did a follow-up episode with me defending the game. There were some choices made for the US adaptation, which I know. So I interviewed Ken Heith, who worked on the adaptation, and the adaptation was done in rather very low budget and rushed circumstances, manuscript being handed to Ken Heith, who reading it was like, oh, I would prefer to play factions which technically are the bad guys, which are the Templars, and kill Nephilims rather than be a Nephilim. And I'm sure there's many inspiration than that, but that's Knight's Black Agent, but that's not Nephilim. But you can tell in the US adaptation, there's kind of a misunderstanding what Nephilim are. Of course, there's this contradiction of you're the good guys, but you do possess humans. But in the US version, it became much more action-packed. There were some choices also. There's a mystery at the end, spoiler alert, but at the end of the Nephilim US adaptation, they decide that a certain dictator from World War II with a small mustache was actually a Nephilim, and that flies in the face of the game in the French version, because in the French version, part of the principle was, yeah, you're powerful, there's the secret history, but the idea is always still humans who make history. It's not in secret. Nephilims control everything and so on. And doing that was like a bit of in poor taste. And also, I think the thing really with Nephilim, not that I don't think US friends could not appreciate the game. I think at its core, really, there's something quite European, or because there's really this idea that you walk around places, you know, you work in cities in France and also in the UK or Italy or even Belgium, and you've got those layers of history. You know, you see a building and it was from the times of the Saxons, and you're in France, you see something from the time of the French Revolution, and then you see something which, you know, a bunker for World War II. Yeah, there's so many layers when you do that in Europe. In US history, it's got a different shape, heritage, patrimony, in terms of being surrounded by it in a way which is so obvious. It's not quite the same as it is in Europe. And when you play Nephilim, this really, when you start enjoying the game, at least back in the days, it was very fun to then walk. There's a lot of things about learning about symbols also and secret societies and history. And then you walk around a place and you start noticing, oh, wait, hang on a minute. That's a Freemason reference. Over there, those Roman numerals is this thing. Oh, over there, I'm in the city of London, and there's a, you know, the ruins of a temple of Mistra here in the middle of the city. And in Nephilim, it's, the adventures are really like, oh, well, yeah, there's a temple of Mistra in the middle of the city. And if you go to that stone and touch it, you find a secret passage, and then you find an actual secret society in here. So the idea of running around with Nephilim around New York, for instance, not that there's zero history, and there's definitely history before colonization, but it's not preserved in stone, and you're not overexposed to it as you are in Europe. And it's a big part of the feel of the game. And I think when they did the US adaptation, they sort of missed that a bit.
It sounds really intriguing. I really want to play it sometime.
Did you listen to my actual play? Because I worked very hard to do an actual play about it in the spirit of the French one in English. And it was quite fun because I had a French player who was could speak English. There was myself game mastering. There was a British gentleman, Rob, who was a big fan of Nephilim, who happens to be bilingual as well. But so it was funny to have the French-British perspective. And at the same time, I had a third player called Mira, who had no clue whatsoever what the game was. And it was quite a nice mix to sort of, show what the game can be like, and the typical setup of, oh, you're being woken up by other Nephilim, and now the Nephilim tell you, oh, you should be so grateful, now you're going to do what we ask you to do for a little bit. And by the way, we are on our journey to find this Trojan Ark artifact.
DD Miles!
So, what would you say was the balance of French or French-speaking produced games to games in translation or games that were just imported in English that had to be translated? What was the mix of that?
I would say it's a bit 50-50 and maybe even a bit more in French by French-speaking publisher. The 90s, it was very fascinating because it was, at least in the scenes where I was, it was very, very balanced. There was no one single, again, maybe Vampire the Masquerade, but by no means it felt like D&D 5th edition over the last couple decades. So you had a very large number of titles. You had a couple of, you had a designer who was quite popular named Croc on Nightcrawler, which was kind of Blades in the Dark before Blades in the Dark. It was a game where you played only rogues, but you could be a rogue who was an acrobat, a rogue who was a safe piercer. You could play a rogue who was the face who keeps talking. You could play a rogue that would just rob people by hitting them in the face. So that was Nightcrawler. You had Dark Earth, which I really like, which was post-apocalyptic. So in all world in the future, but trapped under a big cloud. So it's darkness almost everywhere on Earth, except in a couple places, which are like volcanoes with a kind of a column of light piercing the cloud, landing on individual volcanoes, protected cities in there, and they have to send people out into, you know, the wasteland, which is in complete pitch darkness, to find artifacts from the ancient times, which of course are all times. And at the same time, they got this big religion about the light. Another one that followed kind of the Nephilim path is In Nomine Satanis Magna Veritas, in which was really Good Omens. In this one, you play demons. Mostly servant of Prince Demons, and depending of who your Prince Demons is, you've got different set of powers. And eventually you could play Angel as well, and it was extremely satirical. It was adapted as In Nomine in the US, so they already removed the Satanist from the cover. And of course, for good and bad reason, it was watered down substantially the satirical dark humor for the US audience.
There seems to be a familiar theme in these games where it is quite esoteric about factional play. And one of the things that was striking about your podcast as well is that thing of story.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, people were quite big on, I mean, they didn't call it that, but I guess you can draw a parallel when people nowadays or a few years ago said role playing, not role playing. So yeah. It was not about dice. It's funny because in the 90s, people in the French speaking seem quite on the narrative side of things in comparison with, you know, things from other places. It was all about the story, the writing, the art of it. And at the same time, there's definitely an indie scene in France, but there's also the same people were a bit forward looking in the late 90s, early 2000s, seems quite entrenched sometimes against, you know, different practices of role playing powered by the apocalypse and this sort of thing. It's got traction, but it's not quite the same as they do. The indie scene exist and is thriving in France, but you really have two very antagonizing groups between the people that played the games in the early 2000s and the new indie ones in a way which is much sharper than it is in the UK and that it seems to be to some extent in the US. But yeah, it's If you think people go hard against each other in English-speaking circles, I can assure you the French-speaking ones can be even more aggressive towards one another.
One thing where we have diverged is that you have become a successful independent publisher and game designer. So how did that come about?
As a former podcaster, I admire your segue. That's beautiful. I'm waving at my Italian publisher who's co-publishing Magic of Inventoring, which is the excuse for tonight. So yeah, I haven't touched the podcast that much actually over the last 4 years already. At some point, I got an idea for a game through reading a self-help about decluttering your interior by a Japanese entrepreneur lady called Marie Kondo, who later had a Netflix show. Interestingly, the first time she was ever mentioned to me is in episode 3 of The Rollist, which is especially a random episode, but you can hear the person telling me about that Marie Kondo for the very first time on my show. And a thing I love is, well, I love the Monty Pythons. I love Airplane, Abram Zucker. And whenever I'm exposed to anything, no matter how serious or sometimes can be tragic and it's a coping mechanism, my brain immediately takes the thing and change its setting to something that makes it silly. And in that book by Marie Kondo, there were quotes by her clients. And it said, one of the quotes said, "Oh, wow, I would never have imagined that getting rid of just only one object would have changed me so much." And when I read that, I was like, this is Bilbo Baggins. A customer was Bilbo Baggins and said, yeah, Marie Kondo was like, you know, does the ring spark joy in you? And I was like, well, I don't think it really sparked joy in me, so I'm better going to throw away and give it to Frodo. And, you know, there were other quotes, and it was ridiculous. It was very fun to take Marie Kondo and imagine her in a completely, you know, fantasy setting. And then I was like, and I was, you know, I'm in this bedroom, in this bed over there. I was like, hang on, what if it was a game? What would it be like? And I was like, well, the object, they would have an encumbrance because you cannot carry as much as you want. They would have an emotional value because you either they spark joy or not. And then they would be useful or not. And maybe they help you get out of the dungeon and survive and stuff. And yeah, one thing led to another. It became a thing, a game called Paris Gondo, the life-saving magic of adventuring, which was way better than I could ever imagine, and found its audience. And I ran a ton of sessions. Along that journey, I wanted to do a new version of that inventoring game because I put it in a cardboard box at home. I prepared to do a Kickstarter to do that, as one does. And just before I launched, turns out that the wife of an Italian publisher, Alessandra, played my game, loved it, and this Italian publisher offered to co-publish the game and make it much better. And here we are. We've got a Kickstarter about to launch for Magic of Inventoring. So it's the release, myself and Grumpy Bear, an Italian publisher with experience publishing board games, you know, in fancy box, and have them manufactured in Eastern Europe and China, and have something, you know, really proper, like a proper board game. And yeah, it's become much more ambitious, and that's a Kickstarter we launch in January 27.
So how will it be different then? So just talk, so, and for people who haven't played it, just give them a sense of what you do in the game.
So the game starts where most dungeon crawling adventures end. You are at the final level of a dungeon. Already, you already dispatched minions and avoided traps. You already defeated the ruler of the dungeon. So what do you do? Well, you've got the best part ahead of you. You're going to get loot from the treasure trove of the ruler of the dungeon. But out of that treasure, what are you going to bring home? You cannot bring everything home because there's just too much of it. Also, you need to make some difficult decision. Are you going to keep this rusty sword, which you use through the dungeon and you inherited from your grandfather, who was a fighter as well? Are you going to bring that home, or are you going to bring home the piano of Red Sonja, which you found, which obviously, you know, is a huge emotional value, having the piano of Red Sonja is not very useful because it's broken. And of course, pushing the piano back outside the dungeon is going to take an awful lot of time. So you need to get rid of as many things as possible. So you decide, do you keep the piano or do you keep your broadsword? You make these decisions, and based on your decisions, all the members of the party, they are more or less likely to find the exit of the dungeon using their objects and then make it home and feel happy for the rest of their days. So that's the story, and it's a full arc, and it can do it in 2 or 3 hours. And in terms of system, the way it works, dry erase cards, some pre-printed. Every adventurer has got a deck of cards which are their starting inventory. So that rusty broadsword, it's part of the game. It's part of the structure of the game. You got 6 to 8 adventurer class, and you got a different starting inventory, like got some cards in front of me, like the cleric's got a ceremonial chestplate, the bard's got a fabulous attire, the wizard's got an infashionable magic staff. That's your starting inventory. And everyone rolled the stats for 2 looted items. So these are more blank cards. And you roll a stat for the encumbrance, the usefulness, the emotion of the object, and the affiliation. Big part of the game is to decide, okay, you rolled that, but what does it mean? So in the case of the Red Sonja piano, well, you roll a 6 in encumbrance, which is a maximum, a 2 in usefulness, it's broken, a 6 in emotion, it belonged to Red Sonja, and the affiliation is barbarian. You trade the card, you make your final deck, you got the stats of your character are from this inventory, and based on whether you carry or not, you're more or less likely to try to cross a bridge and the bridge will break because you're carrying too much. Whether it's useful, you're more or less likely to be able to dispatch some remaining wandering monster with your piano by throwing it at them. And based on the emotion, you can make it home to your cave and be like, well, I got the piano of Red Sonja, so I was happy for all my life because I was a big fan. So that's how the game works to do. Because one of the things I found out with the game running it, and that's what interested this Italian publisher actually, is that you can really play it without a game master, completely devoid of one, and everybody plays, you can really play it without a preparation. The only thing that's sort of missing, according to the publishers, they needed to put me in the box. So those deck of cards is sort of the instruction, but step by step, rather than reading a book or even a manual. You've got, okay, take the first deck, take turns reading the card. Okay, this is step one. Everybody, please take a prompt card for the dungeon. Okay, the ruler of the dungeon is a creature. Second card. Second player, tell me, what do you know about this creature? And so on. And there's a lot of, over the time me running the game, I've came up with silly little questions about, okay, we're doing the party. Tell me, who's your favorite other adventurer? What do you find so nice about him? Oh, you who are the favorite one, tell us what you find especially annoying about another player. So you're going to have all those steps in a bit like this kind of more games in that vein developing. I find lately there's Lovecraft-esque in a very different vibe, which is a bit like that, you know, kind of in between the board game and the role-playing game or story game. I already mentioned For the Queen, which has got this cryptid deck of cards. Alice is Missing is another one, which is, again, very different team, vibe, and format. But this idea that you got a box, you can find it in a game store, you can pick it up, and with, depending on the game, very little or no preparation, you can have fun for 2 or 3 years and have your introduction for a role-playing game, or you have something to play quickly because the game master was feeling tired this evening and decided to cancel last minute, and you already got the snacks and the other players. So why not play something else? Kind of your analog atmosphere.
We should say that Marie Kondo has actually given up on tidying up, hasn't she? Since she's had children, she said that
Just it was not sparking joy anymore, so she got rid of it. She Marie Kondo the Marie Kondo method. So yeah, it's great. And you know, we decluttered the title. The original title was Paris Gondo, which was a nod to Gondor and Paris. I wanted a gender neutral first name. It still sound a bit like Marie Kondo. So Paris Gondo, the life-saving magic of inventoring, because Marie Kondo's book is called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying. We decluttered the title. Now it's Magic of Inventoring, because it's much shorter to put in a skit, because we don't do tweets anymore. It's also, I found, you know, running it at convention and having also been very lucky to have people run it for me at convention sometimes. I mean, for me, for themselves. we found that we have listing in convention and they shortened the title and it was just written Paris Gondo. And you show up in UK Games Expo and you're like, the Horde of the Thing, Warhammer, or Call of Cthulhu, the Mystery of Innsmouth, Paris Gondo. Doesn't mean anything. It's not evocative at all. Why Magic of Inventoring? If you read that, you're like, hang on a minute, magic? Inventoring? What is that? And people click on the link and look at the description.
Yeah. So just remind us, Callum, when's that Kickstarter from and to?
So it will be running from January 27th all the way to mid-February.
Well, good luck with it. And thank you very much for coming on the Grognard Files.
And thank you very much for people who made it through my ramblings, my excited ramblings all the way till the end of the episode.
The Groggies!
Welcome to the Room of Roleplaying Rambling. It's January, and the wind is whistling around our ears. We're up in the attic. The little pigeon is hidden away in its nest. It is so cold. Me and Blythe are here to warm our cockles with a cup of tea and a bit of chat. Are you all right there, Blythe?
I am, yeah.
Let's get this out of the way. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
It's all right. It's the 2nd of January.
At the time of recording, the 2nd of January. Legitimate to say Happy New Year.
Yeah. This is the Groggies, annual Groggies Award. I have been through the painful process because we had a conversation the other day, didn't we? Try and recall some of the things that we've done in previous Groggies.
The awards we've given.
Can't remember. So I've been through the painful process of looking at the transcriptions. So you know nowadays, you get this AI thing, whether you like it or not, transcribes the podcasts.
Yeah.
I thought, it won't take me long just to go through the various podcasts where we've done Groggies and just look back at the. It did take quite a bit of time.
I can imagine. Yeah. I like the transcription. They do it on Spotify, you get the transcription now, don't you? And it gets everything. It gets words wrong.
It does.
It just gets words wrong.
Have you seen me die, Spike?
Things like that.
Sounds more sinister than I intended.
It does.
Have you seen me die, Spike?
Yeah.
I might actually change it to that.
Sighting podcast. Have you seen me die, Spike?
I've got a little bit of a prefab sprout game, actually, based on the transcriptions that I've observed.
Okay.
So these are common phrases that we use within the podcast.
Yeah.
That have been transcribed by AI. Let's see if you can recognize them.
Transcribed incorrectly.
Incorrectly. Yeah.
Well, we're much of a gamer if you just told me the correct transcription.
Okay. The first one. Mm-hmm. Let's see if you can get this one. Mm-hmm. Listen, Gary.
Lesson Gary.
Yeah. Lesson Gary. You're struggling here, aren't you?
But it does do this, doesn't it? That it transcribes things in such a weird way. You only come to that conclusion. So, Lesson Gary.
It's not made up a word, hasn't it?
Lesson Gary. It's like Listen Gary, but neither of us is called Gary. In any way, would we say Listen Gary? Listen Gary. So, again, sounds menacing. Listen Gary.
If you listen to the AI gurus, what they'll say is this is a form of hallucination, right?
Of hallucination?
Hallucination, yeah.
Who's hallucinating?
Precisely. And what they say is that the AI, if it can't find the results, it hallucinates a result. Now,
hang on. Hallucinates the result? Get out of it. It just guesses. again. Hallucinate. Why are you attaching such a grandiose concept to hallucinating?
It's a market spin. It's a market spin to give the idea that this isn't a load of like numbers.
It can't be just a computer guessing.
Or guessing it wrong.
Something hallucinating. Yeah, because it's like a mind. Yeah. No, is it not?
You won't be able to have a 4 trillion market capitalization value if you actually said, oh, actually, it's wrong.
Well, yeah, what it does sometimes when it doesn't know what's being said, it just kind of guesses
and makes it wrong.
It makes a word.
Gets it wrong.
No, it's hallucinating. Yeah.
Lesson, Gary, is the lasso, Gary.
Of course, now you say it. Now you say it, it's obvious, isn't it? I bet people listening have got that. And I'm sitting here not getting it.
What about oboe? Oboe, as in the woodwind instrument, the oboe.
The oboe. It's hallucinated an oboe. I'm not really good at this.
You'll never replace AI.
If you got AI to guess oboe, would it get the right word?
It would.
You'd hallucinate backwards and get the right word then.
I doubt it.
Go on. What is it?
Oh boy, it's Owlbear.
Owlbear, yeah.
Owlbear and the Wizard stuff, and we mention it a lot, so. Mm. Okay. What about Elbow? Elbow.
Elbow?
Yeah.
Well, I'd say that could be Owlbear as well.
That it is.
It's Owlbear as well.
You got one right.
Hallucinates. Elbow and Oboe.
Yeah, what about Albert? Albert.
Is that Owlbear as well?
Yeah. So you can have an Oboe,
Albert. Albert. Albert's Elbow, Oboe.
Albert and the Wizard Staff is, well, this should rebrand.
Aldo and the Wizard Staff. Guy Garvey will turn up.
So, please stop spoken. It was a perfect spout again.
Perfect spout.
Okay, so this is the Groggy Awards, and I have gone back and looked over them.
Mm.
And I've got some observations of when we're doing this, right? Because when we said resolutions, the first thing I'd say is that we always say that we're going to focus on one or two games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'd never do.
We'll dismiss that. Just take that as a given.
Yeah.
We get hung up on things and the facts say otherwise. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
You give me an annual bad time over the Messianic Megalomaniac Award. And why do you do that?
Because you want to award it to yourself.
Yeah. The evidence shows, Mr. Blythe, that over the years, I've actually awarded it to other people and you nominate yourself every time.
You have awarded it to other people, but I still maintain you want to give it to yourself. That's my point. I think every time I can see in your face, people can't see this because it's an audio medium, isn't it? But people... I see the look in your face. You want to give it to yourself. You do.
You don't say it.
Well done for not doing that.
I've got the spurious gold envelopes here.
Yeah. Okay.
And we'll do this as a tradition. It's not always been a tradition. We started doing this in 2016. In 2019, we decided not to do it. But didn't explain why we didn't.
But we just got fed up of it.
We do that sometimes.
Did anyone notice?
I was thinking of putting
it in.
We replaced it with the first ever Thunder Phase.
Oh, right. So highly original idea.
Never been done before.
Never
been. And also, in the first ever awards, we had two categories that we never used again.
What were the two called? What were the two? Let's just work out why we never used them again.
Okay, the first one was called Back in the Day, Today. Mm-hmm. And that was supposedly scenarios that we'd revived and played.
Oh, right, okay.
And the winner of that was The Sea Cave and Fungi from Yuggoth. So Fungi from Yuggoth won it in that first year.
Mm.
And it's the only thing that has ever won because we've never done that again.
No, it's a one-off award.
And then the other one was the Rigged Rolling Award. And this was supposedly a moment that was created by Dice Roll.
Purely by Dice Roll.
A moment of excitement.
Mm.
The nominees for that was Numenera were Etiquette Rolling Ones.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did.
Succession of
Never ones. Played that again, did we?
No.
Some of the game's fault.
And then the other nominee was actually Stormbringer game that you played at the first ever Grog Meet with Dimbid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He sadly passed away this year. Yeah. So Andrew Jones is the first ever games master at Grogmeet because he ran that feng shui game.
He did, didn't he?
Grogmeet Eve.
Fanboy, yeah.
He had a series of mega criticals in your game. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that, but
possibly you wouldn't have made it up. Evidence says otherwise.
Oh, last night, hallucinated it.
Yeah. So those are two categories that we've never... I'm not proposing we bring them back.
No.
In fact, I'm thinking of dropping some of these.
Even less. For these
why don't we just say... Well, one year we did... Actually, we did one year we said Game of the Year and just had that.
That's it. That's just Game of the Year. That's it. All you're getting.
So I'm looking back at some of that transcript. I'm glad I've done it now.
Feel better for doing it.
I've got it out to my system.
Got it out your system. Realised... Although you were looking for some consistent patterns, there are none.
There are.
So it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
You could just make it up again.
Okay, so let's deal with the, calling it now, the Games Master Moment of the Year.
Games Master Moment of the Year.
Yeah, so this is...
That's the world.
This is formally the Messianic Megalomaniac game. Last year we decided to retire that as a name.
You retired it as a name.
No, yeah, you did.
Did I?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a good thing about these transcripts. I can go back and prove things with
you. I'll shove them in court of law. Even though I'm a judge, I feel I've been turned on me. You know, I put it to you. It was in 2021. You said this.
Got it all written down here. Yeah, so games.
So, but it is, you've got it all written down, but it is an AI transcript. So who's to say they're not hallucinations? I can't remember these things. That'd be the weakness in your evidence, wouldn't it?
What's your Games Master Moment of the Year?
Games Master Moment. Well, I, up front, right, I am banning myself and I'm banning you as well, talking about Pirates of Drunax. Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's a big part, been a big part of our game in life, hasn't it, over the last few years. And we've probably been coming to an end. And we're going to talk about that in a future episode, aren't we? So I'm going to ban it from the awards because recently I have joined Andrew McDonald's DCC game. It's a regular face-to-face game in Manchester. I've been invited to play it for a while because of one thing or another I couldn't make it. But now I've been to several games. And I think it was the first time in my gaming career, if you want to call it that, that I had to roll literally save versus death or die roll. That might sound unusual, but back in the day, even nowadays, and even when I'm GMing, I always kind of recoil at the idea of, right, give me a 12 or more on a D20, otherwise you're dead. That's something you think. I know people like old Scouser, Neil, who loves that kind of thing, but I've always thought, it's a bit harsh, isn't it?
Three dice rolls away.
Yeah, well, this was one dice roll.
Yeah.
Where we were on a magical platform floating across a ravine in Andrew's game. And the wizard lost his concentration. And so we all had to make a saving throw. Otherwise, we plummeted into the crevasse and were dead. And that was it. And I managed to make it. But I realised that's the first time. So I might nominate him for the GM moment where the GM looked us all in the eye and said, right, save versus, that's it, may I save you throw? Otherwise, that's it. I was astonished.
Maybe we should restore the name of Messianic Megalomaniac.
Well, you know, he's not particularly, I don't think he's a mean GM. I'm not saying he's a mean GM, but it was that moment where I realised, I thought, blimey, that was a proper make this roll or that's it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, one way or another, we all made it.
You first mentioned DCC back in 2022. Mm-hmm. And we kind of get this sense that it's a fairly new thing for you.
Yeah.
But you have been slowly being converted.
Slowly being converted over a period of time, yeah. Yeah, it's a slow process. Get you in the end.
Because Andrew first played DCC when you ran it, didn't you? And now he's running it.
Yeah.
You've passed the baton over.
People would say, wouldn't they, when you get to those kind of roles in those kind of games, save versus poison or die, save versus this or fall into a crevasse, you're dead. People kind of think, oh, that's an easy thing to do for a GM. It's just a mean, easy thing to do. But it's not actually, is it? Because I never want to do it. I never have the nerve to do that to players. You know, they'll be playing an old school game and they have the spiders and the spiders. So, save versus poison or die. I always go, oh, save versus poison or lose some hit points or whatever. Because it always seems too harsh. So it's actually quite a bit of nerve, I think, as a GM to go. And we're all like third and fourth level characters. We play our characters a bit as well. It's not like it's a funnel where they go, oh, you're dead.
Did everybody survive?
Everyone survived.
The true test of those moments are when somebody goes, though, isn't it?
Maybe, but we all, I think some people might have failed roles, but some people did it. So I just made the role, but people spent a bit of luck. But you don't know as a GM, do you? I mean, I know, like you said, the test of it is, well, did a character die? But as a GM, when you say, make the saving throw, otherwise you fall into the crevasse and you're dead, you don't know, do you? We could have all failed.
I've been in circumstances like that, like last year when doing one of my games, one of the players was petrified.
Oh, yeah.
Halfway through.
Mm. Halfway through, yeah.
So as a GM, it's not about having those incidents and occurrences. It's what happens afterwards as players, you know, taking the newly formed statue and finding ways to unpetrify it, which they didn't do. They just left him there. But it's what to do with the players.
Yeah.
Do you just kind of handle the character and catch up with the others?
Well, I think what would have happened in that game is we would have had to roll some more zero-level characters who would have appeared on the scene at some point and play those and work your way up from the bottom. Well, I as a moment, I say I enjoyed it because I survived. So it's like, oh, yes, I was brave and exciting and I managed to do it.
I've probably GM'd fewer times this year than I would do normally. And we need to bring up the subject of GMitis.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which I've been afflicted with.
There's no way we could give you the award this year.
Well, we say that, but looking back at the transcripts, GMitis first raised its head back in 2017. I just finished doing my first ever actual play with other players from the RPG Academy, and they filmed it on YouTube.
Yeah, I remember that.
I became terribly self-conscious. Seeing myself, a crisis of confidence.
You're witnessing yourself and all your tics and quirks.
So that brought that on, GMitis. And that passed. But this year, I think GMitis was different. And I don't like talking about it because you know what happens blindly when you mention GMitis?
What?
You get people saying,
Are you okay? Yeah. He's okay. Before you start, he's okay.
But
right. Instead of a GM wobble, you know.
I don't think it is a wobble, though. I do not think it's a wobble this time. I think it was different last time. That was about self-conscious. Becoming self-conscious and thinking, oh, right. And we're playing with different people. And we've never done that before, have we? And you become very aware of, you know, that first time you start doing that, you start being aware of your GM techniques or lack of them and the need to build them up. I think this time it's more to do with... and. I understand why people ask, are you all right? Because when you stop enjoying something that you previously enjoyed, it could be an indicator of something else. But I think in my case, this year, I've done other things. I've been on a course, for one thing, for 10 weeks. I've been watching more films and reading more books than I've ever done. And it makes you realise that it's just part of your life, isn't it?
Yeah.
RPGs.
And GMing is time consuming. We've said this before, haven't we? It occupies more of your brain than being a player. Being a player, you've got to turn up and switch on during the session. And you might think about things outside the session, but you don't have to prep anything. You might play a game and it's part of a campaign. And you might leave the table and think, well, I wonder about this next time. I wonder about that as a player. But that's kind of fun to do that, but it's not too time-consuming. Whereas a GM, you think, right, what's going to happen next time? I need to think about that before, even if it's a pre-written scenario or a pre-written campaign. You still have to do prep, don't you? It's very rare. In my experience, anyway, it's very rare, I think, in yours, that you sit down with a pre-written scenario and just run it completely as written.
And it's that lonely fun thing, isn't it? That is the bit that I've not had the space to do.
Yeah.
That time just to sit down and think, oh, I'm going to create some characters today, or I'm going to have a think about how that scene is going to work. But I've just not had the space to do that. So I think I've enjoyed playing, but the thought of GMing, I've just kind of moved away from.
You can do too much GMing. I think that's the thing with the hobby generally. I think it's good to be both things of a balance of playing and GMing. It's like conventions, isn't it? I like to GM a bit, but I also like to play. I wouldn't want to GM every session. Like these people go to Expo, they run a game every session, don't they? They get the free hotel. And when I ran a game at Expo, they messaged me, just clarify, you're just running one session. You know, this doesn't entitle you to anything in the hotel or something. And I emailed them, I said, yeah, I know that. I'm not bothered about that. I've got a hotel paying for it. I'm not. But there is that thing, isn't it? If you do too much of it, maybe just give you a certain perspective that's just one-sided.
Yeah.
Doing both things is important.
Yeah. And I think it's just important because I think the other thing is that people, you know, when you read discourse over RPGs, people just beat themselves up a bit too much about how much they do and how little they do.
Yeah.
And you just can't say, well, just enjoy it. Do what you can and just enjoy it.
Yeah. There is a lot of that, isn't there? Like GMs, people who... particularly people who've not GM'd before and they were really anxious about it all and getting a bit worked up, and you'd think, be all right.
Just have a go.
If it's with your friends, it's okay.
But even with established people, there's a sense that unless there's like a purist sense to it of, you know, unless you're doing it right or doing...
Yeah.
And I used to participate in that. I used to be part of that problem where I would say, look at what I'm doing, look at what I'm reading. And there's a natural thing of saying that, but it does have a consequence, doesn't it, that when people see that, they kind of think, you know, you can see it, can't you, with people, this idea of fear of missing out, that if I'm not doing that, am I doing it right?
That's an interesting thing, because this year, as I said, going back to Andrew's DCC game, what I would say there, two things there relative to what you've been talking about. I've run a lot of DCC. I've not played a lot. But now I've played quite a bit. And I've quite enjoyed playing it. And it gives you a different perspective on it as a player. So there is that. But the other thing I would say about that game, because it's face-to-face, and as we've said, that's a slightly different dynamic to playing online. It's face-to-face. We meet at 1 o'clock in the pub in Manchester, have a pint, go to Fanboy for 2 o'clock, play till six, have a pint afterwards. It's quite good. It's good fun. We have a laugh. It's good for people would say, oh, is it beer and pretzels kind of game? I would say it is. No, I think it's just how it's supposed to be. I don't mean this in a detrimental way to Andrew or any of the players, but it's fun. It's good fun. There's a lot of laughter around the table. And I sit down and thought, this is really all this kind of...
This is what it's all about.
It's what it's all about. All this damn stuff you read about it. Oh, shut up. Like
what is podcasters going on?
Podcasters me? Going on, giving awards to people. But there isn't. There's a lot. You can read. You read and listen to a lot of stuff about how to do it. It is how you do it. But I don't think anyone around that table's really read anything about how to do it. We're just doing it.
Just getting on with it.
And it's fun. Yeah. It's fun. You come away thinking, well, I really enjoyed that. It was a laugh. It was great, you know.
One of the things I get asked, and one of the Thunder Phase questions that we've been given is in our kind of deck of ones to ask. So I'll ask it now. Is around, how do you find the time? You know, you seem to have a full and active time in doing it. How do you find the time to do it? What's your answer to that? How do we find the time?
I think, like anything, I've always held the view that you have to make the time.
Yeah.
If you try and find the time, you'll never find it. That's the thing to do, isn't it? I think you've just got to be a kind of quite disciplined and think, right, tonight or this morning or whenever, I've got a bit of free time, I'm going to do that.
Yes.
Or I'm going to do this.
Yeah,
and do it. I think it's about making the time. Finding the time is, you'll never find it.
The other thing that I've changed my attitude to is, when I look back over the transcripts, we make lots of references to real life getting in the way.
Yeah.
Sometimes it says royal life getting in the way. But real life getting in the way. And we've discussed this, haven't we, off air, Dan? Quite a few of our sessions and play has been disrupted one way or another.
Yeah.
And sessions have been cancelled because of family or things that have got in the way of it happening. But we've said, well, actually, we say real life has got in the way, but playing games is part of our real life.
It's part of real life, isn't it? That's part of life, yeah.
And I think that's maybe an attitude that you've got to have, isn't it? You've got to think that this is part of who I am.
Yeah, this is what I do. Yeah. This is something I do, so I'm going to make time to do it because it's something I do.
Part of the reason why we got back into this, it came out of the deep freeze back in 2010, was the inspiration of my sister. Now, my sister has got 5 children, ranging from 5 to 25. She's got 3 dogs. She works full-time. But she watches Bolton Wanderers every weekend, come what may. And she'll go to her away matches, home matches, and she makes the time to do it because it's part of her, who she is.
I mean, whether you'd want to make time to do that is, that's a questionable decision. But I tell you, point.
If she doesn't go for whatever reasons, and there are cases where she can't go, she doesn't say, oh, my real life has got in the way. Yeah. Because going watching Bolton Wanderers is her life.
It's not a separate thing. I mean, maybe we're more prone to say real life because most of the games we play, or all the games we play, are about fantasy worlds that aren't real. So, but I know what you mean.
I've never seen Bolton Wanderers play.
I would say that's a fantasy, or a nightmare. Well, who's your nominee anyways?
My nominee? We're
talking around the houses here, aren't you?
Yeah, and looking at the transcripts, that's what we do every time.
Yeah,
but my nominee is going to be Roy Duffing. This year I started and concluded the 6 seasons in Star campaign for Ringquest Grantham. And I really enjoyed it. It was every Thursday every fortnight. And for people who don't know what that campaign is, 6 Seasons in Sartar is a published campaign. It's part of the community content. The way that it works is that you're part of a tribe. It's actually in all the stuff that you do on tables, character creation. You remember that. Yeah, it takes 3.5 hours.
It takes 3.5 hours and then Eddie's character was killed in the first hour. Exactly. You just have to do it again.
Well, imagine doing that over 6 months. Right. Because what are you doing?
Okay. Yeah.
What you're doing is creating your character, but taking them from being teenagers to being part of the tribe and going season upon season, year upon year, till they get to the point where you're fully initiated part of the tribe. So you're actually playing through.
Like a life path kind of thing that you're playing through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very distinctive. And Roy has played this a number of times now, taken a lot of plays through it. And it's got a bit of a legendary status, particularly the way that he does it. Because last time we talked about a cast of thousands, didn't we? Now, this campaign has a cast of hundreds. You're part of a community. They all have a significant role and consequential role in your life. But rather than having a big data dump of these are the people, and Roy very cleverly, and there's like a pre-sequence, so you have like a credit sequence before each session, before each season. And part of that is to establish who you are in that season, so what stage you're at, but also foreshadowing some of the people that you're going to meet.
Well, that's a good idea, isn't it?
So the names stick, and you've also got...
So you've not met them yet?
Not necessarily, no. But
they'll be... Yeah.
They're part of your community, they might be your uncle.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's just reminding you that this uncle is going to be a part of this next session. And what that allows you to do during the session is just look up, just remind yourself who he is, and what place he is to me.
Yeah, so it's not like sprung on you where you go, oh, I remember him, he's my uncle, isn't he? God, well, I've forgotten about him.
And then you have to have a break. Everything to explain to you. Right, so.
Yeah, I like that.
And what helped me appreciate it is that this Haribon clan is up in the hills, up in the mountains, quite far removed from other people in Dragon Pass. And the analogue that Roy used was, Afghan tribes up in the hills. Whatever's happening, whatever form of government is in the rest of the country, they're hardly touched by it because all they're bothered about is surviving from 1 week to the next, forming their own community. Brings out the background through incident. So you learn about the culture, and the relationship between the culture, and you discover this ancient secret. It's revealed to you through adventure and things that you've got to interact with. So that was really good, and Roy had a really good way of presenting it and presenting all the characters. He did do that thing of saying, so how does your character think about this?
Yeah.
And that was good, and I think what that drew out of us as a group of characters.
Yeah.
So they were like teenagers, so it's like a teenage, that sense of being between knowing that you're going to go into adulthood, but also dealing with the fact that actually you're a bit naive and you're not very good at some of these things.
Yeah.
So he really handled that though as well. And it was formed a really strong bond between the other players as well during that session.
The games we've both been talking about, you're not playing in my DCC game.
I know.
And I'm not playing in your RuneQuest game. So we've nominated GMs. I can't say give it to Roy. You can't say give it to Andrew because you're not in that game. That's quite weird though, isn't it now?
It is weird.
That's weird. I mean, talking of your transcripts and going back to 2017 or 2018 or whatever, that never really used to happen, did it at all? We might have done at conventions, we'd play different games, but we were never stuck into campaigns or ongoing games separately, were we? That's kind of a strange thing. And what's also strange about it is the difference between those two games. There are different ends of the gaming spectrum, aren't there? Mine involves going to the pub, going into a game shop and fighting monsters in a completely bonkers gonzo dungeon. And yours is like a life path creation, what do your characters think about this kind of thing. It's kind of really interesting that where we both ended up this year.
My grandfather died in battle and I felt
grief
and emotion, real emotion, a sense of, this is really sad.
That this year, that's what's happened. We've gone slightly different directions, but opposite ends of the gaming continuum. Not quite opposite ends, but very different.
Yeah, within the spectrum, it's very different.
It's very different, yeah. I think that has to be a joint award.
We're growing as people, Blythe.
Yeah. I'll give it to you.
Yeah. And I'll give it to you.
Oh, okay.
Okay, next up.
That's not fair. Give it to Roy and Andrew. Come on. Come on, don't be mean.
Give it to Roy and Andrew.
There you go, joint. Sure.
Ignore this. It's a rug covering a hole.
Okay, and here we go. Next is the Olive Kinsberg. Players, and the people who play.
This is the one I never remember who it's for or why.
I suppose this is your player experience, and you've kind of touched on that.
I suppose, yeah. The DCC experience has been.
What other experience would have been a highlight this year as a player?
I think, again, sorry. I do sound like a cultist, don't I? One of my highlights as a player was playing in Brendan LaSalle's X-Crawl Classics game.
Oh, yeah.
At Expo, which I really enjoyed. Largely because he's a good GM. He's kind of quite energized and everything. That's what was good about it.
And he allowed your rogue to be a rogue.
He allowed this. This is the fascinating thing about it. You see, again, in Andrew's game, it's the first time I've ever had to make a roll 15 or more, you're dead. In Brendan's game, I would say that's the first time I've ever been allowed by a GM to be a rogue. So it was like, they're not quite, in X-Crawl, they're not quite called, I don't think they're called rogues, but it is essentially a rogue, you know, move silently, climb surfaces, all the kind of thiefy things. At one point, I apologized to him because I was kind of, every room we went, you know, I said, can I try and hide in shadows? And he went, yeah, try it. So, yeah, you're hidden. Right. Okay. Can I climb along the wall? Yeah, you can do. Yeah. Roll it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I was kind of hiding and backstabbing all the time and climbing the walls, climbing the ceilings and scouting ahead and all these things. And I said at one point, we had a break and I said, I'm not ruining this game by doing all this. And he said, no, that's what you should be doing as a rogue. That is what you should do every time you go in a room. Roll for this, roll for that. Well, what was amazing was he allowed me to, because I've played so many of those kind of games where you say, can I hide in shadows? Oh, no, not now. GMs, is it? No.
There's not enough shadows here.
Not enough shadows. Or you're in the room now. And you think, well, what's the point of this? What's the point? And of course, the point is in those games, you know, people often look at, thieves in D&D. Oh, they've got 30% chance of hiding the shadows. What's the point? Well, the point is you should roll it every time. Every room, roll it and be allowed to roll it. because that's what you're supposed to do. And we talked, didn't we, in our DCC episode about playing Lightmark, because that was a DCC campaign and we participated in. That's probably the longest run that I've done of DCC, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed being a player, because it gave you that feeling of, I've played these kind of characters before, but I've always feel like I've never quite been allowed to do the things they're supposed to do. And that's what made it very, very, a very enjoyable experience.
We've managed to play quite a lot of games. Well, like six, and that's probably the most we've done for the last few years. With Eddie GM.
Yeah.
His Han campaign, which for me is probably the most nostalgic experience that we have. You know, if we want to say that part of this experience is rekindling what we had back in the day, that's got to be it, hasn't it?
Yeah.
There's just something about the sun coming through the window, edited. And they're only short sessions.
The HAL maps
come out. Yeah. And it's a typical Eddie scenario as well.
Mm.
And so it's got all the characteristics of an Eddie scenario. It's largely based on Lord Valentine's Castle, Robert Silverberg's campaign about the amnesiac.
That's right, the amnesiac kind of prince.
That we're on the hunt for.
We're on the hunt for. And his soul's been trapped in a jar somewhere, hasn't it? So he's calm. He's kind of an amnesiac, but he's not quite himself, is he?
No.
His personality's been sealed up.
And there's some conspiracy that we're slowly unearthing from place to place that is trying to swap out the rulers.
And I suppose as well, the system, it's open quest, isn't it? So it's kind of basic role-playing. So again, that has a nostalgic kind of...
And it moves fast. The way that Eddie plays it, it moves fast. Yeah. As I say, the short sessions, because we have a good old chat afterwards, don't we?
Yeah.
We have a quick game and then have a chat.
Yeah.
So I've enjoyed that.
Again, it comes back to that thing, doesn't it? That's part of what the hobby's about. It's about socialising with people and having fun rather than worrying too much about the finer points of it.
Yeah, but that's not my nomination. I'm going to nominate one that's completely absorbing and is.
Okay.
It is about the finer points of it. You can see that I've gone down it. We have gone down two.
We've nine different roads, haven't we now? Yeah, we have.
Because
every never play again together.
Every fortnight, except when I don't, we're playing Unknown Armies.
Oh, yeah.
Which has been a great experience. We've learned the rules and the setting as we've gone along, as players and as a GM. It's set in modern times, which is unusual to do, isn't it? To set it in contemporary environment.
Things are often set in modern times, but not quite now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
So we are a group of campaigners, CRAP. I can't remember what it stands for. But we're writing the title of...
Maybe it doesn't stand for anything.
It's some of that campaign.
Maybe you just are.
Crap. We're in Hereford, and this is a real-world issue, the river is polluted. And we're trying to get to the bottom of why the river is being polluted. It's part of some technocratic...
Necromancy.
That they're trying to build up regulations and to kind of bureaucratize. I think by polluting the river, they're going to get more regulation. But obviously, it has real world consequences.
Mm.
And we're unearthing great plots by various fae and the Clown Prince, as represented by Boris Johnson. One of the highlights of this year, my character is an adept who's obsessed with fire and was blowing up a Rotary Club where Boris Johnson was visiting so that the sewers exploded in a demonstration. If that isn't eccentric enough, what about releasing loads of battery ends during a rave? Because we need to have the rave as part of the ritual magic.
I think blowing up a Rotary Club with Boris Johnson present wins you the award. I think it's indisputable that as a player, if you've...
Nobody was harmed during this explosion. It was just a visible
Was anyone harmed in the game? In the game world, though? I mean, no one was harmed.
No.
Just clarity. No one was harmed.
There might be people who were treated for dysentery, both as players and in the real world. That's an interesting point you're making there, because it's tied to, we've got so into it,
yeah,
that it starts to overlap into our lives.
So you now see Boris Johnson as the Clan Prince. You see him that way.
I've always seen him as
well. You've always seen him that way.
That's not changed.
Yeah.
But part of our role is we're trying to engage with Fergal Sharkey as an influencer to try and win our cause.
Mm-hmm.
And Kia, who's also playing, was also trying to, in his real world life, trying to contact him. And I said, well, I can do better than that. Because as part of the game, we're lobbying the council at Hereford. And it just so happened that the next day we played, I was at an event with a Hereford councillor sitting next to me. It was like the real world was bleeding into the game.
You'd be careful. So what about that Clown Prince?
Yeah.
You know, the dysentery outbreak at the Rotary Club. What are we talking about?
Those chickens.
He said, sat next to me, leaving the chickens. It's the Rotary Club, a bunch of technomancers.
I could go into the mechanics then, the mechanics work, but maybe we should do that another game. I'm going to run a game for you.
Oh, that sounds good.
It's good.
I like sound.
And I think my enjoyment of Unknown Armies is being helped by the release of one battle after another, which doesn't have magic in it, but is essentially that story of broken people trying to make the world a better place.
Well, if you do get Fergal Sharkey involved, don't invite his perfect cousin. Irritating fella.
Yeah. Well, the
sheets. What's this about here?
Yeah.
Mm.
And what I like to do, he doesn't.
Mm.
Right. Next, next up.
So you see, we're going to that. Going to that, it's going to your experience playing that, then, is it? You're forgetting about the award. You're forgetting about opening the golden envelope. Open the golden envelope.
Oh, God.
It's like the golden envelopes don't exist.
Okay, let me open this.
Yeah.
What was our games with Eddie? But it wasn't even nominated, but gets it by a win.
Okay. There we go. Fair enough. Well done, Eddie.
Are you sure it's my round?
New Kids on the Top, the tabletop. Ooh. So this is a new game that we've played and experienced during this year.
Yeah.
And what have you got?
Mythic Bastion Lab. Played Mythic Bastion Lab.
Oh, yeah, we didn't we?
Mythic Bastion Lab. Like that.
And this is a kind of Pendragon type game, isn't it?
It is. It's a bit like Pendragon, where you play knights, different types of knights. It uses the Into the Odds system, doesn't it? But it's a little bit tweaked, the combat system. There's a little bit more to it, which I think actually makes it better, a bit more going on. There's a few, your knights have different tricks and stunts that they can do, and they have special powers. It's a much more magic-rich world, Dan. Pendragon, I would say. And some of the knights have magical abilities, don't they? You know, they can shape change or do stuff like that. So
I'm going to do that callback actually to Leoness. It feels like a much more of Diablovancian world, doesn't it?
Mm,
As depicted in
Leoness. And the idea is with it, and this is, I suppose it's a slight problem with it, but we'll come on to that in a minute. But the idea is you explore. It's like a hex crawl. So you have an area of land that has knights. You have to go into that land and tame it and deal with certain myths and legends and problematic characters that might be monsters or they might just be misunderstood. And that's the idea. You go in and it's got... In the rule book is basically... The rules are relatively simple, but the rule book is a load of... It's quite an achievement, actually. Got a load of... playbooks, knights kind of playbooks. So I'm sure there's about 70 odd different knights you can play. You pick one, you roll stats, but you get, like a playbook thing. There's a lot of them. And then there's a lot of these kind of myths that it's called, these myths that are all like little plot hooks that are adventures in themselves. And again, there's probably about 70 odd of those as well. There are different ones, myth of the goblin, myth of the wyvern, myth of the this, myth of that. Oh. And you basically, it tells you how to create a hex and create an area and drop in three or four of these myths to be resolved. And then there's these things called omens, which are like encounters that hint at what's going on. So it's like a procedural game, but there's also the lonely fun thing of creating a landscape.
Yeah, and I'd say the experience of playing it, and this is what Chris does really well, isn't it, is that sense that the players are discovering the world as it emerged from playing in it.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, we were talking earlier, weren't we, about the data dump thing, but it's just relevant to the encounters that you have, that you find out the significance
of it. But I suppose the tricky thing with it is we've played it as one shots, and it works. It does work as a one shot. It's worked and it's been good fun. But it does feel like more of a campaign game. It does feel like a campaign game where you explore an area, and things gradually emerge. Whereas as a one shot, you've got to try and direct things a little bit more, and it does have a bit of guidance in the rules about running it for one shot, how you should do it. But I suppose it's the same game, but the flavour of it, the style of it, is slightly different in a one shot.
I played Blade Runner for the first time. I ran a game of Blade Runner, but it was the height of my GMitis at Albo or Albert
Albo. Albo.
Yeah,
Albert Albo.
Albert the Wizard stuff, ran it there, but it wasn't quite satisfactory. I didn't quite get what I wanted from it.
Mm.
It just came away feeling a bit nonplussed by it.
Yeah.
I feel like I need to give it another go out and give it a bit more time. Probably doesn't fit in a convention, probably needs a few sessions to get it working. So I'm not going to nominate that, although that's a new game. I'm going to pick one that it's fairly new to us, even though we started at the very beginning of the year, and that's Fall of the Delta Green, which gumshoe, I suppose it's taking Delta Green into gumshoe at the end of the 60s, early 70s, and all the kind of world events that were happening there. This is a point where Delta Green was an official organisation within the US government. It was recognised before the agent became burned out and had to go under cover. And I've enjoyed getting to grips with the gumshoe system because, you know, I played Night Black Agents, but like lots of systems, there are little quirks in each iteration of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And
trying to catch you out a bit because you think, I've played this game before, it'll be fine. And then there's little quirks that you think, that's different. I have to remember that.
Yeah.
So
one of the things is the lethality rating of guns, because this is the more real world consequence.
Yes.
Whereas Next Black Agents is all about the
Jim Bond and it
movies.
Yeah. Movies, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas this is if a gun's got a lethality rating and an automatic fire, it just does 12 damage regardless. And whatever you roll on top of it.
Yeah.
So, which is enough for you usually to shred people.
Or be shredded.
Yes.
That's the other problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, let's not forget, well, as players, we're fine to shred the enemy, but don't want it on to us.
I'm also getting to grips with how stability and sanity work in effect. And getting that steady disintegration of your characters as they're getting hardened by events that they're exposed to, which is what you expect from like
that's the kind of game it is, isn't it?
Yeah, Cthulhu game. Yeah. So I'm really enjoying getting to grips with that. But we did discover a flaw with Gumshoe, don't we, that we want to point at you. So the investigative skills thing were the straw man that Gumshoe is meant to defeat is you get the clue, don't you? You get the clue.
Yeah,
you never get to the point where you roll on a deck.
So if you've got history, for example, you've got a point in history, that means you're an expert in history, and therefore if there's a history clue, you get it. You don't have to roll for it. You also make a history roll 30%, like in Cthulhu.
It's pointing out that thing, isn't it, where, you know, you might have botany, but you might have it at 10%.
Yeah. So the GM wants you to get botany, that are the clue. Therefore, if you've got in gumshoe a point in botany, you'll get the clue. There you go.
The difficulty is, if you don't have botany, you've no bloody chance.
Which is what happened. Yeah. I said, I've got botany. No, no one's got botany. Oh, right. Well, does that mean they can't have the clue? Oh, right. That's just as...
In fact, it's worse because you've got 10%.
You've got 10%. If everyone's got... If five players and they've all got 10% botany, someone might do it. But if no one's got it, well, you can't have it then. You can't have the clue. But I thought the whole point of this game was to give us the clue. Yeah. It's a bit odd like that. I find it a peculiar... I must admit, I'm enjoying the game. I'm enjoying the kind of that Vietnam setting. It's a good game, good scenario and everything. But the game itself is a bit peculiar, I find.
Yeah.
It's one of those games, and this happens sometimes, doesn't it? There are sometimes there are games that you read and you think, not sure about this. And then when you play them, you think, oh, it's really good. Gumshoe, Paul Delta Green's, it's the opposite. When I read the rules, I thought, oh, yeah, I like this. I like all this. It's good. But when I play it, I always think, well, it's a bit weird, this. Ben's system is odd as well.
Yeah, on general abilities.
Yeah, it's really on the general abilities. Well, to do stuff, basically, you've got a roll of four or more on a d6, and you've got points. So if you've got 4 points in that,
it might be a different...
It might be a different threshold. It'd be something more difficult. If you set four, basically,
it's a standard one.
And if you've got athletics, 4 points in athletics, before you roll, you can spend... A point, 2 points, 3 points. You could spend four, couldn't you, if you wanted to?
Yeah.
You know, you spend 3 points and guarantee success, or 2 points. When you run out of points, it's just kind of weird things as a player where you think, oh, so my character's an ex-marine and he's got, I think he's got 11 points in shooting firearms. So he's like a crack shot. But it's surprising in a fight how you run out of those points. And then you think, well, what is it? Has he forgot how to use a gun now?
Yeah.
I mean, I know they explain it as a narrative thing. I think this is what's odd about it. They explain it in the game, I think, as a narrative device.
Yeah. So save them up, because when you'll need them.
You'll need them. You might need them
when you get the
big boss at the end or whatever. Yeah. But of course, as a player, you're thinking, this might not be the big boss, but it's a fight. And if I don't spend the points, they might beat us. So I'm going to spend points.
Yeah.
I don't want to stay alive. I don't want to go, I've only got 11 points in shooting everyone. But you know, I'm not going to spend any fighting these Viet Cong bad guys who've got machine guns, because I want to save them for later. But people would say, well, if you do that,
we're going to get taken.
They're going to get shredded, aren't we, by their machine guns? So spend the damn things.
Yeah.
But no, right now I've spent them all. All right, now it's the big boss at the end. Which end of this gun do I use? I can't remember now.
Yeah.
It's odd. I do find it odd. I'm enjoying playing it, don't get me wrong. You know, I don't think it's like a terrible system or anything, but there are bits of it that are quite difficult to get your head around as a player.
Yeah.
Maybe it's me not quite.
No, I don't think it is in it.
I think
the measure of those points and the general abilities of those spotlight ties where your character is meant to make the significant difference being part of it. But you're right, if you've got an adventure or scenario like the one we've got where you're in a place of danger,
yes,
you're going to need... to protect.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's a good observation. And that's how it's kind of been, actually, when we've played it. So when we've been in, like, Saigon, investigating stuff, it all seems fine. Yeah, or I'll spend a point of preparedness to have a torch, or I'll spend a bit of sales to sneak and follow some. That's all fine. But when we got dropped into the jungle, and we crash-landed in the jungle, and we thought, oh, we're really in a mess now. We're really in trouble.
Yeah.
It was like athletics rolls to get out of the helicopter alive. Oh, I've lost all my athletics now. That brought it in quite sharp focus where I thought, oh, this, we're burning through these points, aren't we? We've not really done much. We're just staying alive. We're not even out of the jungle.
Yeah.
That's kind of, that's all to think about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. When you're in, when the danger cranks up, the points disappear pretty quickly.
Yeah. And what the something like Knights Blockades does, because you're more capable, because it is more of a movie emulator, is that it gives you chances to refresh during the game.
Now,
you know, I'm being a bit more generous in, because it's a big operation. So giving points where you can't refresh. And I think you have done now, aren't you? Now that you're to the jungle.
Yeah.
Let's get the envelope.
Okay.
Missy Bastian Land.
I wonder what AI will make of that one in the transcript. Missy Bastian Land.
One of the things that we do as part of this is to give awards to all the people, the groggy of the year.
Yeah.
Because this thing of ours has been built up like an online community, but it has a physical dimension as well, doesn't it? It's grog meet next week.
Yeah.
Next week, blimey. When we put this out, it'll be all over.
It'll be over, yeah.
Let's hope those tables and chairs don't work. If those tables and chairs
don't turn up,
nobody will hear this because it'll affect me.
Affect your own death, yeah.
That is the point where...
Affect your own death, yeah. I'd affect my own death as well.
Yes.
But I'm not hanging around to take the rap for it. You're going to leave your clothes on Southport Beach, so that'd be a different beach. It looks weird if it's on the same one.
You go to Southport, I'll go to Mark.
Okay.
Same day.
Yeah.
Because they kind of build up a story, won't they? Yeah. And make everybody feel guilty about how they were complaining that there were enough tables and chairs.
Yeah.
I'm telling them to drug me, there weren't any tables.
Not complaining now. Well, maybe they are. So maybe they would be.
So part of is an online community. Part of this physical community, yeah. People getting together who hadn't played like 4, 5, 7 years ago, and they're playing together as a consequence of listening to the podcast, which is a great thing. But it's not really, it's something that's happened by accident. And it's not down to us. It's happened. Mm. It's down to the people out there who do it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put forward this time for nomination for creating a London chapter of Grog Meet.
Yeah.
Grog Law.
Yeah.
I think it's called Grog Law because it was near the law courts originally.
Yeah.
And Grog Love.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to nominate Dave Patterson and Jim Mosley for creating that. So
excellent.
Joint winners.
Yeah. Joint winners have to share it.
Yeah. For creating that.
Mantelpiece.
Put it on your mantelpiece. Well done. Groggies of the year.
Excellent. Well, good. Good painting, yeah.
Dave and Jim.
Yeah.
And then the last bit of business we have is who do you think's been nominated or who do you think's won the Grog Pod of the Year as voting on by the listeners?
God, I don't know. I'm not good at this. I can never. I think we have a bit of an in joke, don't we, me and you? But what do we know?
Yeah, what do we know?
What do we know? Because we can never really tell when things are going to take people's interest or not. It's kind of quite unpredictable. So
I don't know how this works when things are joint. So I'm just going to say that there's a joint second and first place because there's two on each.
Okay. Joint first and joint second. Yeah.
Yeah. I never know how it works because in some, in those rankings, it means if you got a joint first, it eliminates the second place. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean, yeah. Because it doesn't have to. You can make it up. It's all made up. It's not like, no one's going to complain. I'm sorry about this. But in the traditional awards, if there's two joint, you know.
You'd be surprised.
I would be, yeah.
Second place, okay, is in joint second place.
Yeah.
Dungeon Crawl Classics with Brendan.
Okay. Yeah.
And 10 Years of the Grognard Files.
Oh, okay.
There you go. That was it. So in joint first place, and these were contested right to the bitter end of the poll closing, Magic in RPGs with Stu Horvath.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody said that was like listening to David Bowie and Kate Bush talking about role-playing games. I don't know what they meant by that.
Who said that?
But there you go. And then the other joint winner,
I'm going to come back to that. Go on.
Is Swedish RPGs.
Oh, yeah,
Magnus Theatre. And you like that one?
I like them all, obviously. Apart from the bits where I'm speaking.
Yes.
But
I try it, Bush and David Bowie. I try and cut as much as I can.
But you can't cut it all out. That's what makes me laugh. But Kate Bush and David Bowie, who's who, though?
I'd like to think I'm Kate Bush.
Oh, God. No, that's a thought. Don't put that thought in my head. The lovely Kate Bush is you.
Yes.
And he's David Bowie.
I don't know why.
What AI will make of that?
I've got all the attacks underneath this.
Chainmail one. Babushka.
Cheers, Blighty.
Thanks. You've ruined everything.
There isn't another bit.
Thanks to Callum for spending the time and
talking to us about French-speaking RPGs and his new Kickstarter. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I do promise to look at some more gaming cultures. If you want to recommend somebody who can give us a good account of other places where games are played, I'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for sharing this. And most of all, thanks to the patrons who keep this show on the road. And we have a whole host of different things you can get if you're a patron. You can get extra podcasts, access to our online gaming community, and loads of stuff. And do you know what? We've got another project bubbling away in the background, which I don't really have time or space here to tell you about, but I will do next time. We did promise last time that we would be going chaotic. Well, we bumped that along, and that will be coming quite soon. So hold on to your hats for that. Get ready to rock.
I didn't know.